It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. WPR is going out into Wisconsin communities to get answers to questions that voters care about. And voters care about drugs in some surprising ways. We're spending this portion of our morning, as we do most Tuesdays, with Bridget Bowden. She is, of course, the project manager for Beyond the Ballot. Bridget, welcome to the program.
Morning, Carrie.
Bridget Bowden, welcome. We are talking to people here. You are asking questions, but you're not asking questions about specific policy issues. So it's always kind of interesting to hear what they bring up. Tell us what the listeners are responding to here.
Right. So our questions are intentionally very vague. We want people to talk about what they want to talk about, what issues they actually care about. The questions that this issue is coming up the most in are question number 2, which is, what is the most important issue to you? Mm. And question number 6, which is, what's going on in your community that no one is talking about?
And a lot of answers to both these questions are drugs.
Correct. Yeah, we've heard people who are concerned about drugs or not concerned and excited about certain drugs and perhaps wanting them legalized.
Like the legalization of marijuana.
Correct.
So tell us more about what we're hearing from them. Cynthia Preston is from Milwaukee. What does she have to say?
So exactly, Cynthia Preston from Milwaukee, and we asked her what issues people weren't talking about enough, and here's what she said.
They're not talking about the drugs, drugs and stuff. Some, you know, that should be a factor about they getting help for people out here on drugs and stuff, what they're doing, and should be a program. And because there's a lot of people out here that need help.
A lot of people out here that need help, and there is no help for them. We hear this around the state, don't we, Bridget?
We do, yeah.
So we've talked on this network before about how politicians are trying to address the opioid campaign. What are Wisconsinites saying in other parts of the state?
I mean, the opioid issue is something that we hear about a lot. This is Rosie Brandenburg. She's from Milwaukee, mm-hmm. and she says heroin is a huge issue in her community. So here's Rosie.
Everyone I know, including myself, knows someone that was like affected by heroin and has now died from a heroin overdose with lacing of fentanyl and everything like that. So I think those are all issues that affect like the young people around us a lot.
So you also talked to another person about heroin. Tell me about what Travis Haling had to say.
Travis Haling, also very concerned about the heroin issue, and he's from Green Bay. And so he says it's something that politicians aren't doing enough to fix. So here he is.
It's not something that a lot of people talk about, not a lot of politicians talk about it, but the heroin epidemic is huge in my community, and I wish they'd do something about it.
Mm-hmm. So this is not just a Milwaukee thing. This is in Green Bay. It's huge in his community. We've heard these reports all around the state. Are you hearing them in rural areas, too?
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the things that I think is really neat about this project is that we are getting a pretty wide sample geographically around the state. And, you know, people do care about different issues in different parts of the state, but there are some issues that we hear about everywhere.
So we're per reporting from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, we know that at least 16 Wisconsin counties and 2 cities are addressing this issue that you brought up at the very beginning, the marijuana legalization issue, in some fashion. Sometimes it's for medical reasons or sometimes it's for a recreational marijuana. What are we hearing from the people that you've interviewed for Beyond the Ballot?
Yeah, I mean, legalization of marijuana is something that we hear from people. Obviously, not everyone. There are some people who do very firmly disagree with marijuana legalization, but some people are very much in favor of it. So here is Carl Ball, and he lives in Milwaukee.
I am a bipolar person. I've had some anger problems myself, and I medicate with marijuana after a long day of work. I don't go out and attack people when I smoke weed. When I get drunk, I get into bar fights. When I go out, you know, there's that. And when we legalize marijuana, let's put that money into our public education and fix the schools in Milwaukee and the nation.
Fix the schools. Did you hear that? He had 2 prescriptions there. It wasn't just legalized pot. It was, and let's use this money to fix schools.
Right, that is what he was saying and what he wants.
You also have audio to share from Kirk Stone. What does he want to do with pot?
Yes, Kirk is from Madison, and he actually said that this is one of his top issues this election season. So here's Kirk.
Well, one of the things I'd like to actually see on the ballot is legalized marijuana. I'd actually like to see it for the medicinal, as well as research into for cannabis used in other industrial hemp. I'd like to see it, and there's a movement in all the states around us except for Wisconsin. So I'd actually like to see that as an opportunity to be presented on the ballot. I don't know if it will be or not.
So, but it is on the ballot in 16 counties. So Wisconsinites will be able to vote on it a little bit here. Some listeners, meanwhile, are thinking about the topic of drugs. Tell us about Ron Knapp.
So Ron Knapp is from Allenton, and he, when we asked him what is your top issue this year, he actually said border security. But when we asked him why, he explained a little further. So here's Ron.
We need to get a grip on what's coming in through our borders, whether it's by boat, ships, or if it's coming across by car, truck, people. It's infiltrating, and it's going to take our, in my opinion, it's going to be one of the causes of our country fails. We spend a lot of money as a society on drugs. We have a son that's an addict. He's in recovery. It's a problem.
So Ron is pointing to the drugs that come over the border.
Right. That, you know, he said border security was his top issue, but then the reasoning for that has to do with drugs.
And did he say anything else, like that we need to do things to help people stop being on drugs? You know, supply and demand, there's always a demand for the supply.
If I remember correctly, and I didn't personally do this interview, he did talk a little bit about treatment as well. But this is what he said to that question about what's your most important issue.
So we're about 8 weeks out from the midterm election. What is being done? You're collecting all this sound as part of Beyond the Ballot. What are you going to be doing with it after the election?
Right. So it's really crunch time right now with this project. So we are, you know, still going out and doing interviews. We are almost at 400 interviews, so we're getting there. Mm. And then we are using those interviews in the news that you hear on WPR. So when you hear a story about an election issue, chances are some of those interviews came from the Beyond the Ballot project.
At the beginning of this conversation, we talked about two of the questions. What is the single most important issue, and what is the one that nobody is talking about in your community? But what other types of questions are you asking on this?
Yeah, we're asking people, are they voting? Simple question. We're asking people to tell us a story about a time the government did something that helped them, and then the opposite, a time that the government did something that hurt them. We're asking them what questions they have for the candidates, and then also if they feel reflected by their elected officials.
We have talked about a lot of Beyond the Ballot issues with Bridget Bowden, and you can go to WPR.org/beyond to look at the issues that they are exploring. You can also sign up and ask the answer the questions yourself. Bridget Bowden is the project manager of Beyond the Ballot. She's with us most Tuesdays to explore these questions. Thanks for joining us today, Bridget.
Thanks, Carrie.
Again, you can go to WPR.org/ballot. I'm Carrie Kaufman. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Our culture loves pregnant women. We want to touch their baby bumps, though they don't necessarily want us to. We love to talk about our birth plans, and there's this new ritual, the gender reveal party. Our guest today thinks that having rituals surrounding birth are good and healthy, but does this public sharing of pregnancy infringe on a woman's privacy? And what do these new rituals say about our cultural hang-ups with women's bodies? Laura Tropp is a professor of communication and media arts at Merrimack Manhattan College. Her research explores media environments, gender, and culture, and she wrote this book, A Womb with a View, America's Growing Public Interest in Pregnancy, which documents this shift of pregnancy from a private to a public experience. Laura, I love the name of your book. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So it's fair to say that we are consumed with pregnant women and the mothers that they are to become in this society?
Yes, I've seen it in all different ways. I mean, what inspired me to first write the book was actually a personal experience. And I was pregnant with my son at the time. And I once was at a party with my husband, and I saw him, and he was holding a sonogram of the baby and showing it to a stranger. And afterwards, I just walked over. I was like, you didn't ask me before showing the picture to a stranger. And he's like, why would I ask you? I'm like, because that's the inside of my body. He's like, I never thought about it that way. And I thought, how interesting is it that we've become so consumed and have gotten so used to pictures and representation that we've kind of forgotten that women are a part of this process sometimes.
So is this a consummation with pregnancy, or is it just we want to show everything? We want to take selfies of everything, even the inside of people's bodies?
Yeah, I think it's both. I definitely think that technology kind of has played a role in both our ability to do it and our interest in doing it. But even before the rise of selfie culture, I was observing this trend. So I think there is also this interest in moving pregnancy from this kind of very private realm to a much more public realm.
Okay, so this public realm is manifesting in the celebrity culture that we see. We see celebrity baby bump watches, and I don't really care. I see this at the grocery store, and I'm like, why should I care if she's pregnant? We see these gender reveal parties. Talk to me about how that kind of came up and became kind of a part of our everyday lives.
Yes, it's been very interesting. I actually talked to a couple who I think I can't prove it, but I think they might have accidentally had the very first gender reveal party. And what had basically happened to them was that, because this was for them about 10, just about 12, 13, 14 years ago, and she'd gone to the doctor to have an ultrasound. She was going to find out whether it was a boy or a girl. She was very excited, and her husband was late, never made it to the appointment. And she was so upset that the doctor was like, you know what? You don't have to find out right now. I'll just put the answer in an envelope, and then you could just find out with him later. And it was this very organic process. It happened for a reason. And she was like, oh, that's wonderful. And she was so excited, and they went home together and found out together that they were having, I think it was a boy. But then for her next child, she said it was such a fun experience. She decided, let's do it again, and this time let's have a party and have everybody there. And now I've noticed this trend of, you know, it's become a popular thing. In fact, I was just talking to somebody at a grocery store, a stranger who was telling me how excited he was. He was buying all this stuff for a gender reveal party. I was like, you know, I didn't even think people had ever heard the term. And now I have this like man talking to me about gender reveal parties. And I think that what we're noticing with these trends is the idea that new rituals are developing to kind of celebrate the pregnancy experience. And there are different types of showers. There are the sonogram moment. There are people gathering together to you know, help pick out baby clothes, help pick out pregnancy clothes. That what we've seen is that pregnancy has become segmented. And that, you know, it used to be like you were pregnant or you weren't pregnant. And people would laugh at the idea that you're just a little pregnant. But I think now you can be just a little pregnant and you can be embracing the entire pregnancy experience. And part of it is kind of showing it off to everybody else.
We are talking to gender and culture expert Laura Tropp about the obsession our culture has with pregnancy. We're taking your calls here, too. Are you pregnant, and do you mind sharing with the rest of the world? Do you think it's really cool? Have you ever had a gender reveal party? Are you planning one? 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. One of the things that I think about when I go back to I don't really care if X celebrity has a baby bump, if there is somebody that I'm working with, I may or may not notice that she has a baby bump. I don't always look that closely. But is it okay for me to say, oh, well, you know, we talk about this celebrity's baby bump. Can I ask her about hers?
You know, it's such an interesting question because I've talked to women who were so excited when people noticed their pregnancy and others who didn't want to notice. I had this one woman I spoke to who told me that she became pregnant at work. But she was a work culture.
No. She became pregnant at work.
Yeah, she became pregnant while she was working.
Okay. Just to be clear. She became pregnant at home.
At home.
While she was a family.
But she was not ready to out her pregnancy. But she was concerned because her culture at work was that they would go out drinking. And she was afraid that if she didn't have that drink, that everyone would automatically mark her as pregnant. And she did not want everyone to know this. So she made these little private arrangements with these waiters and waitresses at every restaurant they went to, telling them she's pregnant, but she's pretending she's not. And she's going to order these real drinks, but you have to serve her kind of a virgin version of the drink.
Wow.
And the waiters loved getting in on it. And she said she faked drank throughout two pregnancies. And I thought it was such an interesting experience. And she was laughing about it. But it was also this idea that, you know, you feel watched when you're pregnant. And some women really don't want the experience to be public. It's a very personal thing. So I think to answer your question, you know, you don't know for sure. You kind of have to wait for people to kind of tell you their clues of how much they want public involvement in their private experience.
So women's pregnancies are public now, but this is a new thing. When did this start to change?
Well, you know, I trace the rise to kind of shifts in early technology. So that once we see the rise of the ability to peer into the fetus, so ultrasound technology began in the late 1970s. Also, at the same time, the ability to have, you know, individualized pregnancy tests, and you could take the tests at home, comes around the same period. So they start to become more popular, and especially the sonograms around the 1980s. And now the fetus is not something that's just kind of this mystery and this solo experience of a woman, but it's also an experience that others can share. And I think this is the point where you start to see pregnancy kind of move from just a focus in the womb to this focus of the public. And I think Demi Moore's being pregnant on a cover of Vanity Fair is this big public moment in the 1990s where people were like, oh, you can show off your pregnancy. But I think she has this moment in part because of the ability to peer in before.
You know, there are a lot of women who saw that and said, I don't look that good when I'm not pregnant. There's no way I'm going to show my baby bump and show my entire body when I am pregnant.
Well, in fact, one trend I've noticed is that people are mimicking these experiences in their private lives, not necessarily sharing them to the public. So I spoke to a lot of photographers who have these pregnant packages. Where you can go and not just get pictures of yourself while pregnant, but also sometimes even experience what the photo shoot might be like if you want to pay for the full package. And I asked them, well, what do they do with these big giant pictures of themselves afterwards? Because I also felt the same way when I was pregnant. I wouldn't want a giant picture of myself that way.
Right.
But she said that a lot of times they hang them in their bathrooms or in their bedrooms, or they find these kind of private spaces to capture these moments that are really important to them.
So talk to me about pregnancy 100, 150 years ago when we didn't have these tools to know that we were pregnant. We didn't have ultrasounds. We didn't have kits to test yes or no. How were the pregnancies different back then?
Well, one of the most important things was that pregnancy was the realm of the woman. So women, they didn't even early on, you know, for sure, if you were pregnant, menstruation was not necessarily a sign for women because they didn't have the same health standards we were. So the pausing of menstruation wouldn't necessarily mean you were pregnant. They had actually in early periods is called piss prophets, and their job was to kind of analyze the urine of women and try to assess whether, you know, they were pregnant or not.
Which is kind of what we do today.
They were surprisingly accurate, actually. So, you know, you laugh at these kinds of early trends. But one thing that was interesting is that the woman had the sole kind of, you know, decision making. So she felt the quickening. She was the first to really feel the baby kick and to know that she was pregnant. And she could decide to tell other people or not. And she was surrounded by women. They were kept kind of private. It was a woman's experience. Things were done at home. It was not very medicalized. So in many ways, you know, it didn't have a lot of what we probably take comfort in knowing today about knowing that you're likely to survive. But on the other hand, the experience was much more the realm of the woman. She didn't share it.
Okay, so it was the realm of the women, but also weren't infant mortality rates and mother mortality rates higher then?
Yes. So that there was no kind of guarantee that you were going to make it through the pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, though, women were constantly told to watch out, that every thought they had would influence the baby. So the theory of maternal impressions, which developed in like the Renaissance period, was this idea that if you thought wicked thoughts, that you could have a monster baby. If you had bad dreams, that your baby would be deformed. And women felt that kind of pressure and power. What's interesting to me today is that even though we've come a long way, I think we still attribute a lot of what mm-hmm. women do to their pregnant, you know, belly, and then to the potential baby they're having, in a way that scares women even still today, even though their mortality rates are not as much to be concerned about as earlier periods.
We are talking to Laura Tropp. She says that pregnancy has gotten more public and it used to be more private, and we're exploring that on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Our culture loves pregnant women. We want to touch their baby bumps. We want to ask them about their pregnancies, and we want them to celebrate in front of us. Laura Tropp has written about all of these rituals, and she wonders at the publicness of our need to have them. Why does 21st century U.S. culture love pregnant women so much? Are you pregnant? Were you pregnant, and did you feel scrutinized by people more when you were pregnant? Did they ask you things that you didn't particularly maybe want them to know? Was this something that you wish that you could do over? 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Laura Tropp, you're a professor of communication. You study media and gender in society. And I got to say the name of your book again, A Womb with a View, America's Growing Public Interest in Pregnancy. So I want to get to, you mentioned before we stopped for a moment here, the medicalization of pregnancy. And I want to get into that a little more. Talk to me about how we have become more medicalized.
Right. Well, there was a shift from home to the hospital in about the 19th century, and, you know, particularly in the United States. And the thought was that babies and mothers would be safer in the hospital. And, you know, it took a little bit of time for that to happen, but at some point they did become somewhat safer. And in this case, it's helped a lot of women. But on the other side of it, we've medicalized a lot of pregnancy, and some of it may not need to be medicalized. And we pathologize some of it that probably, you know, we shouldn't be doing. And we also have to pay attention to the fact that the outcomes are not necessarily the same for everyone, so that women of color in the United States mm-hmm. do not have the same, you know, mortality rates as non, whether they're rich or poor, which is a recent report even.
So how do we over-medicalize?
Well, in some ways, we make every symptom to be a potential medical problem. Mm. And that's not necessarily needs to be there. And we also have the constant ultrasounds and the constant sonograms. And, you know, some midwives feel that's not necessarily necessary at every visit to have that. So we have, when you push something into this kind of medical process, you see certain types of control. So sometimes the woman's instincts are superseded by the doctor's instincts, and that's a problem. And we notice now that with women of color in particular, their symptoms are sometimes dismissed.
So women come in and say, I'm kind of like confused by this. Women come in and say, I want these tests. I want of this invasive stuff. And doctors are saying, no, let's not do that.
You know, it's kind of both sides of it. Sometimes doctors are doing more invasive tests than are necessary and medicalizing births that don't have to be medicalized. But at the same time, they're not doing it for all women. So what they found with women of color is that they might come in and say, something doesn't feel right. And they're kind of dismissed and ignored. Their symptoms are not acknowledged as much.
So medicalization, though, going to the doctor for every little twinge actually sometimes saves lives. I mean, if somebody has high blood pressure and doesn't know it, they could have something that could hurt them and that could hurt the fetus.
Yes, there are certainly times where medical attention is necessary. And there are times also where it probably isn't. And what we have to do is figure out in our culture, when do we want to privilege that science and when do we don't? And what we're noticing is there's this unevenness, particularly post-birth, so that a lot of time is spent on assuring healthy outcomes for pregnant women, which, you know, no one wants to complain about. But afterwards, the women are not really paid much attention to. Their first post-visit is usually 6 weeks later. And that's sometimes too late to catch postpartum depression and serious problems.
So you wrote about your pregnancy story and the story that you share with your daughter. And one of the things that you mentioned in there was that you had an amnio. And I was wondering, is that part of the medicalization that you're talking about?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, for my, that was my third child, and I was simply over the age where they said, they would, at this point, they said they recommend amnios. And I remember thinking, well, I don't know, you know, if I was going to a midwife, would she recommend an amnio? And it became this kind of tough decision about whether to have one or not, especially since they didn't suspect anything necessarily wrong with the baby. It was just standard operating procedure.
Yeah, I actually had the same exact experience and the same exact wondering about it afterwards. We are talking with gender and culture expert Laura Tropp this morning about pregnancy and the publicness of pregnancy. And I want to talk about, we've talked about what women gain when they're pregnant and people celebrate them and what have you. We've talked a little bit about how private it was a couple of hundred years ago, but let's talk more about privacy now, you know, especially in the workforce. How can that affect women when people know they're pregnant and it maybe isn't seen as a good thing?
Yes, we've been seeing a lot more attention being paid to the fact that the workforce has not really caught up to this pregnant culture in many places. So that as we celebrate and, you know, can be consumed with the pregnant women, we don't think about, well, wait a second, what about when they go to work? You know, they're not going to be just purely celebrated there, especially at jobs that involve, you know, physical work. So that we're noticing more and more pregnant women going to work, and now they're saying, well, the other workers or their bosses, I see pregnant women all the time on TV. I mean, in one case, one of the quotes from one of the bosses in a case that went through the courts was that, well, he'd seen Demi Moore do a flip, so he didn't see why, you know, one of the workers would be not be able to do her job expectations, which involved some types of physical labor. Mm-hmm. And it was so interesting how now we are applying these kind of popular culture images of pregnant women and setting these new expectations for the workforce. And it doesn't fit because some women aren't able to work the jobs they have during pregnancy. And no one's quite figured out what to do with that.
Right. So what strikes me is that we're trying to say, hey, you know, everybody's equal. And then we also say pregnancy takes something out of you. And are you saying that there needs to be a cultural shift, that we need to be okay with some pregnancy taking something out of you and not make that an issue in the workforce?
Yes, I think that what we've done is sometimes we've kind of forgotten that there is a person who has to go through the physical labor. Mm. And that when we get so focused on the body and celebrating the body or the baby and celebrating the baby, that we forget about the person behind that. And attention needs to be paid for, is there going to be new types of accommodation? Is it going to be new types of being able to work in different ways? How are we going to account for the fact that, you know, it used to be that pregnant women couldn't work. You know, they were just expected to kind of stop working and spend the next few years of their lives, you know, having children and raising children. And now we don't expect that from women. They're welcome in the workforce, except when they're not. So now we have to kind of catch up to that.
We are talking to Laura Tropp about our obsession with a culture of pregnancy. 800-642-1234 is the number that we would love for you to share your pregnancy stories. Have you been discriminated against at work because you are pregnant? Did you try to hide your pregnancy, as Laura explained earlier, by doing things like going out with your friends, with your work friends, and surreptitiously not drinking alcohol. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Laura, we had a little fun with this here. I want to play a clip from the sketch comedy show Inside Amy Schumer. To set things up, this clip shows several pregnant women sitting in a room together talking about how they plan to give birth. And here's part of that conversation.
Have you guys figured out your birth plans?
Oh, yeah.
For all months. I know is I want a natural birth and definitely not an epidural.
Oh, my God.
I mean, of course not.
It's better for the baby.
It is better for the baby.
So much better for the baby.
Yeah.
We are having a water birth, but instead of water, we're going to fill the tub with gender-neutral barley, which is also the name of the baby it will be better for.
Oh, my little barley.
You see, love how that goes together.
My midwife suggested a sea turtle birth.
What is that?
Oh, it's when you give birth on a beach and you dig a small hole and you kick sand on the baby and you see if it crawls into the ocean or into your arms.
Wow.
It's better for the baby.
It's better for the baby. So we've talked about the medicalization of pregnancy, but there's a trend going the other way. And Amy Schumer satires that trend very well. Talk to me about that and how this fits into this publicness of pregnancy that we're obsessed with.
Yes, that once we notice trends becoming public, we start to lose sight sometimes or power and control of whatever it is. In this case, that, you know, as pregnancy became celebrated, as women were allowed to be more public with it, that was wonderful. But now we're noticing almost too much obsession with it, mommy shaming, if you will, that, you know, these like strong expectations and conflicting advice. That it used to be that women could only get advice from their family members, their mothers, their sisters, their grandmothers would be the ones who would kind of guide them through the process. Then we had this ability to have expert advice coming from books, as we see the increase of book production and shifting out to all these different places. But now we have this kind of self-sharing of advice. So then on the one hand, you could talk about any embarrassing symptom you have on a website of some sort, in a blog, and share it and listen to other people tell you about it. But on the other side of that, they're going to also give you constant advice, and you don't know anymore who to listen to and what's true. Should you have a water birth? Is it safe to be there? And you get embarrassed. So people don't want to say, hey, I'm not planning on breastfeeding my baby. I don't want to do that, and worry about being judged constantly.
Even saying you want an epidural will make people judge you. So this is like a competition, labor, breastfeeding, how it's going to be better for the baby. What strikes me, and we'll get to this in a moment, is that we're not necessarily talking about what's better for the mom. So we will be back with Laura Trope in a moment, and we are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. What do gender reveal parties reveal about our culture surrounding pregnancy, and why has pregnancy become such a public offering? Laura Trope explores that and many more questions in her book, A Room with a View, America's Growing Public Interest in Pregnancy. Laura, we have a few calls coming in, and I want more to come in, 800-642-1234. But I want to ask you about this question first. We talk about it's better for the baby, it's better for the baby. Do we ever talk about what's better for the mom?
No, the mother tends to be kind of missing from this equation. In fact, what happens is that abruptly after giving birth, you know, the mother is pretty much forgotten. And I talked to this model who had told me this story about doing, you know, a photo shoot before and after photo shoot she was hired to do. And the photo shoot when she was pregnant, it was fabulous. She felt she was glowing and everyone was bringing her food and water. And then the photo shoot after, she said it was terrible. She said she was like leaking and no one really cared about her. And they were just looking at the baby. And she just felt so kind of invisible. And I think that's the way a lot of women feel.
We have Dave from Price County. Dave, welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning. I just wanted to throw in the idea that although in today's culture there are, you know, there are lots of choices for, you know, like the clip you just played about how to give childbirth or how, you know, how to go through the experience. But a lot of the medical response, I think, had to do with, you know, what's better for the baby is to make sure the mom survives. Mm. And we come from past, you know, centuries of sometimes childbirth being very traumatic and the mom not making it. And I think some of the procedures that have come forward were to try to stop the loss of the mom during the what sometimes can be a difficult childbirth experience.
Thank you very much, Dave. We also have Mary from Janesville. Mary, welcome to the program.
Well, good morning. I thought your comments earlier about doctors and testing were very interesting because one of the things that I noted when I was pregnant and we moved between so we changed doctors a couple times. And some doctors were very willing to work with me on what tests I wanted and what I didn't. And one doctor in particular wanted me to have every test under the sun. And I finally told him, if you're going to pay for it, we'll do it. but I didn't want to know the sex of my child. Mm. I had chosen to become pregnant. I wasn't going to terminate the pregnancy. And all of these things really rankled this doctor. You know, my comment is that...
You weren't going to terminate the pregnancy. I mean, you wanted the pregnancy. He didn't want you to terminate
right.
it, right?
Well, right. Well, he was like, well, if you have a problem, you know, one of the, with the amniotesis, or amniocentesis, right. you wanted to do this test really badly. And I'm like, I chose to be pregnant. I am not terminating this pregnancy, regardless of the condition of this child. If it's perfect or not, it's still perfect. Mm-hmm. And he just did not go along with that at all. And so, you know, my point is that it is my body. I will do what I want with it, and I will take under, you know, if you can give me a sound medical reason, I will do the test. But if you have no sound medical reason for doing it, I'm not doing the test.
I want to ask you, did you have, I'm assuming you did not have a cesarean section.
Nope, all three were natural births. I didn't have, and they were fast. So there was, with my first child, they had time for an episiotomy, and that was it. and the other two, there was no such thing.
you're lucky, I think. Good for you. Thank you very much, Mary. She brings up something which is really interesting, is that doctors often will push things on women, especially women who are maybe a little older. And also, we have this really strange thing, Laura, where we are scheduling cesarean sections.
Yes, that... It comes from, like, it's the phrase is too posh, you know, to wait, you know, that it comes from Posh Spice and her, you know, her scheduling, it was of her C-section was, you know, popularized and, you know, kind of taunted it by the media. But now it's become such a trend that March of Dimes actually had to do a series to kind of promote people to wait and not have their babies too soon, which is just so interesting. Like when you think about like a cultural shift in society of before you really didn't even know when you were exactly going to give birth. And now we have to be told not to do it intentionally too soon.
Right. We have to, and sometimes we schedule it around our doctor's schedule. That's kind of the interesting thing to me. We have an email from Leslie. She says that pregnancy is more public if you have the ideal body type. I'm a plus size woman, and all plus size maternity clothes are like circus tents. Regular maternity clothes often show off the baby bump or have cute designs announcing the month you're due. It's as though it's okay to be pregnant if you fit an ideal body type, but not okay if you don't. Talk to me about that a little bit.
Yes, I love Leslie's point there, you know, that there's only some people who are visible in this process, and there's still so many that they don't have the pregnancy that is commoditized, that is idealized, and then they're still forced to kind of remain hidden because they're not celebrated.
Mm-hmm. And it's also interesting to me that a lot of times if you're a plus size body to begin with, or even if you just kind of your pregnancy grows and you kind of just look fat, not pregnant, that people just kind of don't even notice that you're pregnant.
Right. And, or other women have complained to me that, you know, after they have the baby, they're told, you know, oh, when are you expecting? And they're just like horrified.
Oh,
that, yeah, that, but the idea that people are able in this time of your life to comment and judge and not even feel bad about talking about your body.
Right. So there's an excerpt from a book by author Megan O'Connell called And Now We Have Everything on Motherhood Before I Was Ready. She writes, who wanted to be a mother anyway? A mom is a relationship, not an individual. Moms nag. Moms are stressed out. I know it's all internalized misogyny and guilt and bad public policy, but I still really can't get around it. So what do you say to this, that as a culture, we don't see women who have babies as women who have babies, but we see them as mothers?
Yes, that there is this kind of loss of identity, you know, once you give birth. And I think part of the, you know, I think everything's a Faustian bargain. You gain things and use things with everything. That once we've lost this 10 month of internal reflection time, I don't think all women are even given the time to think about what portions of their identity are going to be lost after they have this baby. And then they've literally become invisible in many cases. Mm-hmm. And you're not given the tools to kind of understand that, and or even to fight it back. And yes, once you become a mother, it's, I always loved how I went to the pediatrician and immediately he just started calling me mom, which I understand for him, it's a practical thing.
Right.
You know, the same thing with the teachers. It's easier for them just to call us mom. But I thought, oh, how interesting that like my identity is mom now, not even Laura anymore.
That's very funny. And to the grandparents, your identity is the vessel that had these golden children. So I want to talk a little bit more about, though, that this after pregnancy, women feel invisible. What can we do about this?
Well, if we look to other cultures, a lot of other cultures, particularly Hispanic cultures, are a nice place to look, where they have this period of time post-pregnancy where it's acknowledged that the women are supposed to get attention, that they need to rest, they need to be fed, they need to be given all types of resources, that our resources in our country are not devoted to women post-birth. Some people are lucky enough to have people around them, but they still feel often in the United States a sense of guilt for not living up to this experience that they told had will be the most wonderful experience of their lives. And I think that when we celebrate on the first half, the whole pregnancy, and then the women don't feel happy immediately post-birth because, you know, at post-birth, I was not happy. I was glad I had a child. I was happy to be a mother, you know, in a logical way. But I felt very, you know, kind of sad and kind of shocked and kind of consumed by lack of sleep and all this work all of a sudden. And I had tons of resources around and tons of support, you know. But I still felt that way. But I can't even imagine the women who also don't have the resources I had at my disposal and having that feeling. And all the media representation and hype doesn't live up to the other side. So I think we need to spend much more time and devote more resources to thinking about the other half. And some of that might be that not waiting till 6 weeks to see a doctor and talk about this issue.
And that's the other side of medicalization is that we don't medicalize postpartum. So often women are waiting and there's something wrong and they don't know that. Laura Tropp is a professor of communication and media arts at Marymount Manhattan College. Her research explores media environments, gender, and culture. And her book is called A Womb with a View, America's Growing Public Interest in Pregnancy. Laura, well, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Carrie Kaufman. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.